would remind me to remind the others later that we want to get attendance here at 1:30 every committee day. Thank you. We're going to be hopping about today. One thing we're going to be doing here is we're going to be devoting the first 30 minutes to redistricting testimony every Wednesday. And with that said, we're going to go by the order on the sign-up sheet. If we have no one signed in by 1:30, we will proceed at that time with committee business. A little more about what we're doing today. We're going to take some redistricting testimony now. Then we will move to a work session on House Bill 2581. We hear that Senator Brown is going to be appearing at 2 o'clock today. Whatever we happen to be doing at that point, we'll cut over and open a public hearing to take her testimony on Senate Bill 215 at that point. We will gavel out of that, probably back to 2129, and then finish up with 215 again before we're through. So it's going to be that kind of day today. With that said, we will begin our redistricting testimony today. I want to note here that Representative Joanne Bowman has signed up to testify, but she's not here now in her place. Representative March, who will probably pad here for a few moments as we await her arrival. Representative March, welcome.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me?
I just saw Joanne Bowman going down the hall that direction, so I don't know if she's coming back, but she's in the building.
Okay, I mean, we
sent our chase administrator after her. Okay, very good. Representative March, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 15 in Multnomah County. I come here today talking from a point of view of having been through the redistricting process. This will be now my fourth decade. I started in 1971 as a staff committee consultant to the Senate in California. I did that, repeated that in the 1980s redistricting, and I'm joined here by Representative Joanne Bowman. I want to thank the chair for setting aside time for the public to put to provide for input into the redistricting process. It's a commendable and necessary part of the redistricting process. It's particularly important for communities, various communities of interest, minority parties, minority groups, individuals, communities, to have an open and fair redistricting process in which they have an opportunity to speak and to bring forth to the committee their concerns and issues that affect their communities. And I want to thank you for that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Joanne Bowman.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, state representative representing District 19 in Northeast Portland. I apologize for my delay in getting here. I was trying to find you guys. You guys were hiding from me. Mr. Chair and committee members, I really appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. I'm here to share with you my belief that there needs to be significant public input from communities of interest into the redistricting process. There are many communities that would want to participate in this process. I don't think there are too many. I know there are no legislators in this building that were here in 1981 when we actually created in this state the first majority-minority district. That district currently is District 18. It is my neighboring district, and that district was created because clearly there was not in the state of Oregon a district that clearly reflected the diversity of the communities that we have. That was a very contentious process. The legislative body was unable to come up with a plan that was acceptable by the community and many community members that would have been impacted by those changes. Ultimately, it fell to the Secretary of State to develop the district, the redistricting plan, and that plan was approved and accepted. The difference between how the legislative body attempted to do it and how the Secretary of State attempted to do it was significant. The Secretary of State took the time to actually go to the community and spend an awful lot of time talking to people about why it should be drawn this way versus that way and what the impact would be based on any decisions that he would make. And because of that, the plan that we ended up with was a plan that had broad community support. I also want to compliment this chair and also the chair on the Senate side for your vision about making sure that there's a process for the public to participate. But I also want to reiterate that the timeline that we currently have set up per the chairs just does not give us significant enough time so that those communities can have their voice heard. And think about why we do this. Part of why we do this is so that people who are not engaged in the political process, don't really understand how government works, doesn't understand why we have people here in this building passing laws on their behalf. Part of the reason why we go through this process is to help educate the public about the importance of political awareness, political involvement, of understanding who represents you, and making sure that they have the ability to hold the people who represent them accountable. And so if, in fact, we do this process with little public input, then what happens is the public only gets an opportunity to have input after the fact. And as you know, it creates the disincentives to believe that this is our government and this is a government that's working in behalf of the people. I brought some visuals, Mr. Chair. If it was okay, I'd like to...
I'll put them up for you.
Thank you. Because as you and the audience currently knows, we do not have the numbers yet for what the population growth has been from the last census. But what we do have is some population estimates that were created by Portland State University in 1996. So these are probably the most up-to-date numbers, at least for my county, that exist currently as far as how the population is growing and what segments of the community. Now, I talk loud, so if I stand up, you won't have a problem getting me on that recording, will you?
Just tilt that microphone.
Tilt that mic? Okay.
Sure.
And what I want to highlight here is that this particular map talks about the African-American community. Does that one work?
Yeah.
Okay. This particular map, I don't know, it's probably not a real good way to do this. This particular map shows you where the African-American community is in Multnomah County. And if you look, this area here is actually where that new district was created back in 1981. And this has maintained its majority-minority status from that point, from 81 on up to now. I suspect the new numbers will come out and we will find that these numbers have been diluted a bit. And it is our responsibility as the legislators that will be redrawing the line to try to maintain that majority-minority district. And we will have to be creative. We will have to talk to a lot of people. And I suspect we will end up going into District 17 as well as District 19 in order to aggregate the appropriate numbers of the population that would reflect the African-American community. And I also have one that shows where the growth in the Latino population is in Multnomah County. And if you look, there's a significant Latino population in the Gresham area. And that's been growing rapidly. I don't know what the numbers are going to say, but this was in 96, so I imagine that it's grown a bit since 96. And again, the goal would be, is to possibly create an additional majority-minority district within Multnomah County. We won't know that until we get the figures back from the federal government. If you look statewide, what you find is that there may be the ability to create two additional majority-minority districts. And I believe, based on what we know currently about the numbers, that would probably be in the Hillsborough area and maybe Marion County. And so we've got some opportunities to get people involved and connected to the political process that we won't have again for another 10 years. And so, in closing, I just want to say that this is probably the most important work that we will do this session, is redrawing these district lines. This is probably the most important thing that we could do to unify communities around ensuring that their views and their opportunities are there. And if we don't take the time to get all the public input that we could possibly get, then we will find in the end that all the work we've done has been for naught, because invariably we end up either in court battles or we end up in community battles. And I think that if we do it right, we could end up avoiding all of that by just making sure that we're truly talking to the community that we're serving. The document that I provided you in closing has a short list of some of the minorities, some of the African American and Latino organizations that I just came up with a quick brainstorm. I'm sure that if I actually had some time to sit down for an hour, I could come up with a list that would be four times as long. And I gave you that list just so that you could see, just in taking 2 minutes to try to think about how many groups are out there, this is what I came up with. If I had 2 hours, I could come up with significantly more. So clearly there are many people who have an interest in this process. There are many people that need to have a voice in this process. And as the legislative body that has that responsibility, it's our responsibility to give them a voice and give them an opportunity to talk directly to us about how this will impact their lives. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes, Representative, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Certainly no one would be more able than you to help us connect with those groups. And so I'm encouraged if you come up with a list like this with that short of a time to work. We would really appreciate your helping us connect with more.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. For the record, since we're not only on audio here in the building, the Internet and video streaming as well today, would you help us define what you mean by a majority-minority district?
Mm-hmm. A majority-minority district is a district that the majority of the people in that district belong to various ethnic minority groups. And so in the case of District 18, the majority, there are 46% African-Americans in that district, but there's also 26% Latino, there's 12% Asians, and so because of the small numbers of people of color in Oregon, I don't believe we would ever create a district that would be solely from one minority group. I might be proven wrong when we get the new census numbers, but the only time we've been able to do that was because we had such a concentration of people of color in one location that we were able to create that majority-minority district.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bowman, should this committee and the corresponding Senate committee decide to hold hearings in the early part of this process, you would be willing to assist the committee along with your adjacent representatives and senators in trying to see that we receive the testimony that we need to receive, wouldn't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I've gone to two conferences so far on redistricting. I have been actively out in the community telling people for the last 2 years, this is coming. I was a very active participant in the census activities to ensure that we got accurate counts of people in the community, and I will continue that effort on with you and with the chairs of the committees to make sure that we get as many people out and have the ability to have their views heard. So, yes.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Just
for the committee's record also, so that the people understand what some of the difficulty is with the three-person process that's been set up. This is obviously not your district, and it's actually not even in your Senate district.
That's correct.
So there's the need to involve other members of the legislature beyond the three-member group in this.
Thank you for the question. All right. Colleagues, thank you very much for your time. The ground rules that we've established for taking testimony and redistricting on Wednesday says that we will take you in order that you sign up, and you must sign up before 1:30. But since this is our opening session today on this, just open it to anyone who would like to talk about redistricting who has not signed up. You'd certainly be welcome to take advantage of the time that we have between now and 2 o'clock. Anyone here to do that? Okay, thank you. We'll close our redistricting testimony. I think what we'll do here is open a work session on House Bill 2581. Committee, this is a bill that we've had before us over the last week or so. And I think we would have passed this last week had we not run out of time. But we did. Let me just ask the committee, anyone have any particular thoughts or reservations about 2581 at this point in time? We've received some good testimony on that. And if you're comfortable with that, as a committee, if we have no problems with that, I'd be happy to entertain a motion. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've never amended this, correct?
No.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2581 to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and if you're not going to carry it, I would request to carry it.
Thank you. Representative Devlin moves House Bill 2581 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, this bill moves to the floor, and I believe should actually get almost a unanimous vote on the floor. But I would hope that both of us in our respective caucuses would explain some of the facets of this, because a couple of the court cases where we are making modifications may be controversial, but we are actually doing what is required of us as legislators. We've been told that some of our statutes don't comply with the Constitution, and it's our obligation to comply with the courts that have told us that. But I think we need to explain that in caucus before it gets to the floor.
Okay, duly noted. Further discussion? Representative Starr.
Well, I would hope that the carrier would, in his explanation on the floor, would go by a section-by-section explanation of this bill. I would hope that
that's what we would expect.
Okay.
That's what we do in this. Further discussion? All right, thank you. Let's go to the vote. Roll call, please.
Aye.
He is excused.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries, and we will designate Representative Devlin as the chair. Look forward to still it. We'll close the work session. House Bill 2581. All right, as previously announced, we're going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2129. Being aware of the fact that we may have to gavel out shortly when Senator Brown shows to testify on Senate Bill 15. All right, I'd like to call forth on this bill Sean Miller. And Sean, if you would bring your guest, please. Yes, committee, you will notice at your place you do have dash one amendments here, and you also have something of a seat for on this, and that's a fiscal analysis.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. Actually, behind me, today is Grocer's Day, so we have many grocery owners in the building today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. House Bill 2129, if you remember from our last hearing, there was three primary components that we were getting at as we introduced this bill. One was education, getting information out to business owners so we can get more compliance. More compliance, obviously, is more money for the common school fund, but it also would help more of our folks complying with the law. We had obviously, this was a problem where auditors were coming in after us on the back end when, as you very well know from the last committee hearing, not many businesses in the state have been complying with this law because we didn't know it existed. The second component was to reduce the record retention of the amount of time period for which you have to hold records. Currently, it was 5 years you held records, you turned it in, which made a 10-year time frame to hold records that you were responsible for in case of an audit. We have worked with the Division of State Lands to reduce that down to 3 years reporting, which then it would be 6 years, which is still under the IRS requirements for record retention. The last component was an amnesty period, 2-year amnesty period of penalties and fines, so we can get more businesses in compliance with the law without having them penalized and fined under this process. Now, to go through the dash one amendments, again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, following the last hearing, we did meet with the division. We've went through, negotiated through a good, what we believe is a good public policy for unclaimed property. The first section, section two of the bills, the education section, the amendments on the dash one replace educational materials on a yearly basis with regular basis, We didn't want to restrict it to yearly in case they want to do something two times a year. Obviously, that's something we would support. Section 3 of the bill is the prepayment issue. If you remember Patricia Spies with Ross to my right, that was an issue where business owners would like to, at the end of each year, close out their books, and maybe not after they do their due diligence under the current law. If they're able to then get that money off their books, they could do that. And this allows the division to put together rules to be able to do prepayment. Now, I will say the advantage to that, if there is prepayment, money's going into the common school fund faster, which is creating interest at a faster rate. If the business is holding for 3 years, if they were to get it in at 1 year, well, that's 2 years' worth of interest that is being collected in the common school fund. We believe that is a good advantage to the state. Section 5 goes through on page 2 of the amendments. We go through the bill and we replace everywhere we talked about 1 year of holding records and then turning it over to the state to 3 years. That was the agreement that we believe the Division of State Lands and us negotiated on a good middle ground with the ability to prepay if you want to. And so that caveat, the 3 years we were agreeable to. Lines 9 through 15 do the 5 years to 3 years. Again, the advantage getting the money into the common school fund faster, 5 years versus 3 years, well, that's interest that'll be accrued to advantage to the state. Section 9 is the basically this is where we allowed the division to establish rules because there is going to be a transition period from 5 years to 3 years. We believe this was the rules within the bill that would allow them to make the necessary adjustments. I will state that we are concerned with fiscal impact. It's going to say there, and if you can read that, I think you have all copies of that, that they're going to need 4 extra people in that first year to administer the records coming in, the influx of records from changing it from 5 years to 3 years. We believe we're dealing with that in Section 9 of the bill, be able to them to create rules to adapt to that transition period. And again, we just found out yesterday that the concern of ours, obviously, is it's conveniently above the $50,000 mark, which has to have consideration with ways and means. So we're not pleased with that, quite honestly, Mr. Chair. Section 10 of the bill is the 2-year amnesty period. They, again, acknowledged our concern that many businesses aren't in compliance. They would like to be free of penalties and fines and get more people in compliance with the law, which is our objection. So, again, we have a good product here, Mr. Chair, and I want to state for the record, I do appreciate the work that Patricia Spies and many of our members of the association, because many of our members have been audited. Now, many of them haven't been audited, and that's why this law is essential for us, this session, this bill is essential for us. But again, I think we do need to work on how are we going to adjust to that fiscal impact. Do they need 4 people of the influx of records, and that's a question that you'll have to ask the division, because that's something we were unaware of through our negotiations until yesterday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any questions?
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miller, under the Section 2, where you're changing from yearly to regularly, can the notices be longer than a 1-year period, or are those 1-year period or sooner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, the division acknowledged that yearly was probably the minimum. They believe they should do more in education to get people more in compliance. And so we were agreeable to regularly, which meant it's a vague number, but with our conversations with the division, it was to be, we don't want to be restricted to just doing it one time a year, because maybe it's best for business owners to hear from us 2 or 3 times a year, and obviously we were supportive of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the questions, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Miller, I heard your voice quiver a little bit when you talked about 4 additional employees in DSL, which has rapidly become one of my most unpopular state agencies. What is your opinion of 4 extra data entry operators to handle this information over a 9-month period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Guard, my opinion is because I was just sprung on this yesterday, I obviously have some concern with that. They have auditors that are doing, folks that are going out and getting people in compliance. I believe that we were trying to write, and that's why in the amendments of Section 9 of the amendment was to allow the division to make this, put together rules to make for this adjustment period. But from my conversations with them, that doesn't do it, and so I think your question is going to have to be more directed to them. Can they absorb it? I thought they could, but apparently I was wrong.
Thank you.
For the questions? All right. Thanks much. Appreciate it. Next up will be Jeanette Holman from DSL. Jeanette, would you go on this way, please? Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate you being here. Obvious question, the fiscal analysis. Typically, these things arrive quicker than this one did, and I don't know what the story is. How come this one arrived so late?
Mr. Chair, Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director of the Division of State Lands. My understanding is that fiscal does not do these until they get the amendments from Legislative Council. The amendments came out yesterday morning from Legislative Council.
Thank you. How many people work for Division of State Lands?
73
people. I wanted to ask you about the analysis here, and I know this may be just as new to you as it is to us regarding FTE and so forth, and I know you probably didn't have a hand in generating this information. But with 71 people on staff in that state agency, why would we have reason to believe that with that many people in that agency that we would have to bring on additional people to do something that really is, at face value, something pretty beneficial?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a trust division that handles this, and the FTE that are coming that we're asking for, that we think we would need for these 9 months, are people to enter the information as we get it from the holders. We currently have 3 positions doing that. We receive 1 year's worth of information at a time. What we'd be receiving, and yes, we can adjust it somewhat, but the bottom line is at some point in the next biennium, we're still going to be receiving 3 years' worth of information rather than 1 year. That's why we're asking for the extra FTE for 9 months to cover that period of time when essentially our workload is tripling.
As you know, the magic number is $50,000.
I did not know that.
Or something. Really? Okay. It's, the magic number is $50,000 for us to have to send something to Ways and Means. If you would take this back to DSL from me, and that is the fact that I don't think that it's going to take $79,000 and that many FTE to do this. So if you would get back to them and tell them that I would appreciate them coming back with something that the chair thinks is realistic, and that will put it under the threshold, and we won't have to deal with a Ways and Means issue. I think it's arbitrary what they've come up with, and I think they know $79,000 puts it to Ways and Means. So if you could just pass that along and have them come back with something that that I would certainly think is more realistic for this task. I know there will be more to do. That's not disputable. But whether it is actually going to take that kind of addition to do it, I'm having my doubts.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to take that message back.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is concerning additional revenue. Wouldn't there be an opportunity for additional revenue, whether it's increased interest only on the money that's coming in? And was that taken into account on this?
Mr. Chair,
your revenue statement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stark, the division does not get the revenue. The revenue goes to the Common School Fund.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions here?
Mr. Chair, one point of clarification on the amendments, that I don't think Sean probably knew. The new Section 5 that we're adding, the intent there was to clarify some, I guess it was confusion within our own state comptroller's office about unrepresented payroll checks. And that's, we thought we had a vehicle here that we could clarify for them this, that they were included here. So that's why we added it.
One question I have, too, before you go, and that is on Section 9, and that deals with... that deals with rules to adapt to the transition. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, my understanding of what we were trying to do in Section 9 is to help the holders who may be not be staffed up to turn over 5 years or, you know, that extra two-year period and to try to make adjustments for them. Whatever needs to be done. And there may be not a lot that needs to be done, but we did want to have some leeway within the statutes to allow us to do that if it did turn out to be a hardship for the holders.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Bryan.
Jeanette, I'm confused, and I hope you can clear up something for me. I think you indicated earlier you have 3 full-time people that do this job now and that you would need 1 additional person?
The report, the fiscal impact says we need 4 for a 9-month period. So it comes out to like 1.5 FTE in Ways and Means speak.
Are these people being hired full-time for 9 months or part-time for 12 months?
My understanding is that they estimate it would be done in a period of 9 months, so it would be full-time for 9 months.
So it's really 4 additional full-time people for 9 months?
That's correct.
Not 1?
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? All right, well, thank you. And if you would deliver that message back, thank you for your testimony today. Just word to the committee, this is good bill. There's a lot I like about this, and I think we're awfully close to being able to pass this bill out. I am hoping for a much more realistic fiscal on this and expect to see that soon, and we will schedule this for work again soon. So with that said, close the public hearing on House Bill 2129. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 215, and we'll call Senator Brown, please.
Thank you, Mr. Welcome. Chair. I'm very delighted to be here. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 215. This was brought to you from the Senate with unanimous support of all of the entire Senate. Obviously, that's unanimous. It's pretty simple. It requires that any candidate for statewide office, any legislator that is raising dollars during the legislative session, to report to the Secretary of State's office within 48 hours of having received any money for that campaign. The second thing that it does is it creates a right of action for any person to petition the Supreme Court directly to review for failure of the Secretary of State to enforce existing statutes. I understand that there are some potential constitutional issues with the piece that we added to the bill. This was proposed by Senator John Minnis. I know that Greg Chamoff has raised some constitutional questions because it gives any person standing. It doesn't require that the person be injured prior to bringing the lawsuit. So I will let you all wrestle with that one. In terms of the 48-hour reporting period, we felt very strongly in the Senate that this would level the playing field. I appreciate that you currently have a rule requiring you to report within 24 hours of taking a contribution, report it in effect to the Secretary of the Senate, the Chief House Clerk. What we feel this did was broader, and it would allow the public to have notice of anyone who is raising money during the legislative session that could have an impact on the legislative process. Statewide offices, governor, legislative offices. Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Just before I get to that, I want to let you know that we were really prepared to send this along a fast track. And then I received a bunch of amendments here as of late coming from the House side that I have not had an opportunity to digest. And then of course, we got this additional letter from the court administrator that I want to take a look at. So anyway, want to signal what our intention is with this.
Okay.
I think we're certainly in favor of jetting this along, but we've run over a few roadblocks here at the end. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question that I have is, does this require reporting of a statewide elected official, whether a legislator or a governor or secretary of state, in the event that they were raising money during the session for a federal office?
No, I don't believe it would, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr. It also would not apply, for example, if somebody were running for a school board or a county commission office.
Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to Senator Brown. The Democratic leader and I were conferring on the council's report outside the door. In your testimony, there has been a discussion on the House side about changing the reporting time from 48 hours to 24 hours. What do you think the reaction of your caucus members and the reaction of the full Senate would be to that change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I'm sure we would examine your proposal very closely. What I would tell you that the reason we settled on 48 hours as opposed to 72 or 24, and there was a lot of discussion about the reason we settled on the 48-hour period, is because it's certainly possible for someone that's, for example, running for governor for the 2002 election cycle to send out a letter and receive, 75 or 150 contributions of $5 apiece, and to require that person to report within 24 hours could be somewhat onerous. So we settled on the 48-hour period. We also didn't want to go to 72 hours because we felt like it was when the legislative sessions, when things move very quickly, 72 hours could be a month at the end of session. So that's why we settled on 48 hours.
Thank you. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Brown, I, interestingly enough, had a bill that would be could be added on to this. The intent was to include in the voter's pamphlet statement a notice that a particular any candidate that accepted money during the legislative session. Did any of that was that discussed at all? Any of that concept, and if and what were your thoughts about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, we'd certainly be happy to take a look at that idea. That idea was not brought up that I recall in our Senate committee.
Thank you. Further questions? All right.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your consideration. It's a very important piece of legislation. Thank you.
It certainly is. Thank you. Next up will be Lynn Rossick, Elections Division.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, sure. Get them away. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Rossick from the State Elections Division. Just had a few comments about Senate Bill 215 that I'd like to share with you if you do not mind today. As you're well aware, I'm sure, Senate Bill 215 it originated because of an attorney general opinion that the Secretary of State received very early in January, which indicated that ORS 260.174 is unconstitutional and cannot be enforced by the Secretary of State. And as I testified to the Senate Rules Committee when this bill was originally heard, we intend to follow that advice. We are not going to enforce 260.174. The original Senate Bill 215, as it was drafted, would have repealed the contribution prohibition and that's in that statute and replaced it within the same statute using the same number, the reporting requirements that are now part of A and Gross Senate Bill 215. We felt that this was an appropriate action because it repeals something that we, by our council, cannot enforce and replaces it with something that we are assured we can do, and that would be an appropriate replacement. But I just need to point out for the record that the way the bill is drafted now, we have directly contradictory provisions within the statutes. And without explanation, this is going to be difficult for people to understand, I think, that we're going to have a prohibition, and right next to it, we're going to have reporting requirements for contributions during the session. I guess from our point of view, that's not the best way to do business. We would prefer the statute the way it looked originally in Senate Bill 215. I'd also say that I testified and I would continue to state today that the Secretary of State's Office Elections Division is prepared to implement immediately the reporting requirements, whether it be the 24-hour, 48, 72, whatever you choose as the reporting periods. We do not anticipate that this will require any additional resources for our agency. What we will do immediately, I mean, we're prepared, is to scan those as soon as they come across our fax machine or our counter and put those up on the web. And they will be immediately available to the public on our website. So, and of course, they'll be put into the files for those persons who have political committees with us. And then we will check those against their full reports when they file in September. Make sure those are fully reported. Just to let you know how we intend to implement the statute if you choose to adopt it. The other thing I'd like to raise is the Section 13 that Senator Brown referred to, which is the kind of the invitation for litigation section respecting ORS 260.174. As I just testified, we are not going to enforce that statute. It's unclear to us exactly how that litigation might proceed if someone did file, because there is some question in our minds, as well as apparently legislative counsel's, about the appropriateness of giving standing to not just any Oregonian, but any person in the world to bring this litigation. It may be that both the court and the attorney general feel obligated to resist the litigation on the basis of standing because they cannot participate in hypothetical litigation, and we're concerned about the expenditure of resources. The Secretary of State already, through the position that he holds, is involved in a lot of litigation. This is going to be more litigation, and use general fund resources for which we may need to return to the legislature for additional resources depending on what this costs. We're not proposing a fiscal right now because we do have our budget will contain attorney general resources, but we're just pointing out this is more litigation that we're being directed to participate in.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Gardner.
Yes, Ms. Rossi, there is a proposal to add an additional notice to the chief clerk of the House because we do have in-house a rule of reporting to the chief clerk. How does the Secretary of State's office feel about a requirement for them to, when they receive those contributions, report it from a House member, current sitting House member, to the chief clerk of the House?
Chair Wilson, Representative Gardner, I haven't seen that additional language, but I'm assuming that we could set up processes to make sure that happened, depending on what the language is, but I don't think that would be a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you. Representative Devlin, would you explain to the committee your amendments A4 and A5?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These amendments actually have come forward from the Democratic Caucus. The first one, A5 and A4, both of them are actually principle and purposes. They're trying to make the bill that we're considering consistent with the requirements under our House rule. Now, in addition to that these amendments coming forward, we thought that these would be necessary so that they could comply with the House rule. So
since these were drafted, and I received these this morning right before passing them on to you, we have come up with another issue in the House rule that we might have to clarify, and our best course of action may be to get the bill in the position we want it in, and then to modify our House rule, because we've got another issue with the House rule in terms of the House rule talks about a member not actually receiving the contribution for a period of up to 7 days. They have 7 days within which to return it and not report it. So there is a conflict between whichever amendments we consider here today. And, Mr. Chairman, I think perhaps the best way, and I know this is a little bit frustrating for us to deal with this, is beginning in this process when we were talking about the House rule, we sat down with the Legislative Council and we went all over all of these issues and tried to come up with some way to resolve them and bring them all together. And I think we probably need another working meeting with the Legislative Council. Okay. Thank you.
Representative March.
Well,
Senator Brown, would you come back up, please?
Thank you.
For the record, I'm again State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. I just wanted to respond to Ms. Rossick's comments about the changes that the Senate committee made to the bill and why we did that. The original bill deleted the statute, which the Attorney General opines is unconstitutional. We felt as a committee and as a Senate body uncomfortable, or at least the Senate Democratic members felt uncomfortable deleting a statute, A, that we believed in, and B, that no one would be able to challenge, that there would be no opportunity for a court challenge, for a court ruling on the constitutionality issue if we in fact deleted the statute. So while I agree with her in principle, we live in a very political world, and we were certainly concerned about the statement that it might make to the public that we were deleting the statute that prohibited us from fundraising during the legislative session when we felt strongly that we should be prohibited from fundraising during the session. So.
Thank you. Representative Devin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Brown, going along that same discussion, we've had an earlier bill here today, and I think you would differentiate the purpose of that bill, too, because in that bill it's a sort of a rundown of changes in election laws. Several of them are in reaction not to attorney general's opinion in some cases, but to actual court cases. And in those actual court cases, something we have on the books we can no longer enforce. And I think we have to differentiate between those two. I mean, attorney general's opinion is fine, and the state agency feels better following the attorney general's opinion, but the attorney general is not the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon, and I think that's the point you're trying to make.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, yes.
As much as I like the Attorney General.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to have just for a short moment Greg Chamock, Legislative Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Chamock, Legislative Council, what can I do for you?
Just a small question about leaving the part of statute in that's unenforceable at this point. Is there any precedent for that at all in statutes that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, off the top of my head, I can't think of any, but I'm sure there have been a number of instances when the legislature has not repealed statutes that the Attorney General has opined are unenforceable. I'm not aware of a situation where the legislature, while leaving in place a statute the Attorney General has opined is unconstitutional, while at the same time adopting another statute that appears to be in conflict with the original statute.
Thank you. Not a big issue, but I had to ask.
Just one quick question, Mr. Chamoff. From testimony, there seem to be some concerns, and, you know, having briefly read through this letter, about the large pool of people that would be available in court to have standing. What would the your first blush take be of narrowing the pool to just, for instance, registered voters within the state of Oregon? Would that help to mitigate the problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, no.
Thank you for your short answer.
Thank you. Any further questions for these two? All right. Thank you very much. Well, committee, this is, like it often is in this process, something that initially looks like a walk in the park turns out to be a walk to some other place that's not near as pleasant. So what we're going to do is to close our public hearing, and we obviously have some work to do before this thing can go forward. So let's get about that. I think that takes care of all the work that we have today. Any final words? All right, with that, committee adjourned.